This is Orson Welles speaking, and this is Sunday morning, 1 week after Easter, 1 year after the end of the war in Europe, and it's also, inconsequentially enough, the morning after the opening in Boston of the show the Mercury Theater hopes to bring successfully to New York. Here's some notes I made on the back of an envelope. Do you remember that pigeon catcher I told you about last week? Well, I brought it out on the stage last night, but I didn't catch any pigeons. Some more notes. We all remember Martin, Barton, and Fish. Here's a new one, a new firm to remember, the firm of Gossip, Wolcott, and Crawford. Gossip, Wolcott, and Crawford dropped the atom bomb on OPA. If prices get all tangled up in the tail of an inflation kite, remember Gossip, Wolcott, and Crawford. If your savings dwindle, if they're cut in half, remember Gossip, Wolcott, and Crawford. If the landlord wants more rent, if the price of meat goes beyond your budget and the cost of a suit of clothes keeps you in patches, remember Gossip, Wolcott, and Crawford. Ladies and gentlemen, here's a play producer who also speaks, as he's trying to now, over the radio for a quarter of an hour each Sunday morning. He's healthy and strong, just healthy enough to get to the Boston radio station the morning after a Boston opening, and just strong enough to get to the microphone. He's a play producer who's supposed to comment on the large affairs of the world, who tries to speak up bravely in behalf of the future. Well, last night he left the theater, he rented for his play, and walked through the side streets back to his hotel like a man wanted by the police. The most ordinary, cheerful Saturday night pedestrian crowd looked like a lynch mob to this producer of plays, who locked the door of his room when he heard a siren somewhere outside and really thought for a minute as he stood there, bolting himself in, "They've come after me." Here's a play producer who woke up after a night of delirium, fully dressed, on the top of his bed where he had fallen, exhausted, fully dressed, but not too sure of his right mind. A play producer with a normally loud voice who's called so long and urgently for curtains and cues in the past 7 days of rehearsals that he's almost lost his voice along with his mind. Here, in a word, is a play producer. He's full of his own woes and the woes of the small army of very nice and really wonderful people who are working so hard for him and depending on him to get them safely to Broadway. A play producer with a ringing headache and a hoarse voice. His problems have no call upon your attention, and of all the citizens in Boston town this morning, he's one of the least equipped to hold your interest on a national hookup for 15 minutes on national affairs. He hereby fulfills his engagement with his apologies. And since he's added, he'd like to include here apologies to the audience last night who waited through so many stage waits, who watched so many of the wrong backdrops moving up and down with the solemn rhythms of bedlam, who had no way of hearing in that bedlam some of the greatest songs one of the greatest songwriters ever wrote, who could not have picked out of that chaos much of the talent that tried so hard to make itself seen and heard. He hopes to make it all up to all those people Monday night. And meanwhile, on Sunday morning, 1 week after Easter, 1 year after the end of war in Europe, and the morning after a very hectic opening, that's about all the comment this commentator has to offer. Members of the audience at the Boston Opera House, members of the Mercury Theater, and listeners to this radio program, believe me, he is always and as ever your obedient servant. Yes, this is Orson Welles, and please take my hand. Let me take yours. I have my troubles, but it says in the papers you've got yours, too. Let's hang on tight so neither one of us gets lost. Here in Boston, where the hatred of tyranny is a matter of record and tradition, here in Liberty's home address, there's been terrific resentment against the congressional action on OPA. On the commons stand women with breast banners and placards bearing the words, "Save OPA. Protect yourself and your future." Boston's good people are signing petitions in the streets, and I hear from the Capitol that the congressional mail from everywhere is the heaviest in all Washington's history. In favor of continuation of OPA without crippling amendments, it's 10 to 1. A senator was heard to admit the other day that in his mail it's running 25 to 1. What are they saying in Congress? I give you Representative Hartley. They went too far, says Representative Hartley. Yes, the boys went too far, and Representative Hartley was one of the boys. That pink look on the face on the congressional floor was pretty general and chronic these last few days. Oh, yes, the representatives who let themselves be counted on the side of economic disaster have been worried more than some, as Mr. Runyon puts it, and busy, no little, answering mail. Mail from their constituents, and some fun that was, too. Here's a letter on a congressman's desk. "Dear Mr. Congressman," says the letter, "why did you vote for the amendments which will cripple the OPA and make its very existence impossible?" Here's the congressman's answer. "Dear Mr. Constituent, you are laboring under a misapprehension. I voted for OPA, not against it. There were some changes, of course, but I voted for it. Maybe one of your letters has reached a congressman's desk, and maybe it got one of those answers. To such an answer, the only possible acknowledgement is the horse laugh, loud and clear. Loud and clear, the congressmen are squeaking up now in defense of OPA. They put their foot in it, marched right into a political booby trap. Now they're calling for help. The congressmen want us to know they were for it all along. Of course they were. They put OPA in a box and stuck swords in it. If it was any kind of a trick at all, it was a dirty trick, a devil's trick. If it was done with mirrors, the trickers found reflected in the glass only the grimacing, blind face of their own political greed. Have you forgotten the shanty towns that grew up in our city dumps not long ago? The communities built of cardboard? The residential districts developed by human ingenuity out of garbage? Maybe you've forgotten them, but you'll get a chance to see them again. If that House bill gets to be a law, fantastic? Fantastic? Disaster is only plausible when it happens to the other fellow. That's the cellophane wrapping of human optimism. That's what keeps us sane. The train wreck with its 40 dead is credible on the front page as long as the name of a loved one is not printed in black on the death list. The fall of Guernica was a fact the folks in Galveston could accept. The Battle of Britain made terrible headlines in Butte, Montana, in Bangor, and in Beverly Hills. Still, the buzz bombs didn't keep us from finishing breakfast, but Pearl Harbor was fantastic. Reading about the Blitz was like reading the statistics on cancer. We were moved, but not so moved that we sought refuge in doubt. Pearl Harbor was something else again. Thousands of grown-up citizens who knew a good deal about Ethiopia and Manchuria, who'd been following the fall of Europe like a serial, called up the radio stations on the morning of 1 December 7th and wanted to know if that Wells fellow wasn't putting on another Martian scare. So, if I tell you that there are shanty towns in Chungking, you'll believe me, and if I tell you inflation, more than Jap bombs, made those shanty towns, you'll believe me. And if I tell you that inflation is going to bring more shanty towns, you'll still believe me, as long as we're talking about China. Suppose we go then into the realm of fantasy by talking about home. I think you'll believe me then, too. Hang on to my hand so neither one of us gets lost. Let's go now for a little look at commercial rents. Yes, just look at them. Commercial rents are the rents paid for offices and stores and garages, things like that, which are not controlled by OPA. Not controlled by OPA because your Congress refused to extend to your lawyer, your doctor, your dentist, your insurance man, so on and so forth, the same protection you have on dwellings. In Washington, D.C., just for instance, where that refusal was perpetrated and solemnized, commercial rents have zoomed as high as 500%. 500%. In terms of a roof over your head, that is fairly fantastic. But if that House bill gets to be a law, we'd all better get used to that kind of fantasy. I have a bad headache this morning. I'm full of personal weariness and general despair and aspirin, but you'll have to take my word for it that I'd feel just as badly if all the scenery in our show last night had moved on schedule. The audience in the Boston Opera House had lingered for hours to applaud our efforts to the echo. I'd still be full of weariness and despair and aspirin. The crippling amendments on the House bill for extending OPA are worse than all the missed and messed up cues any play producer ever had to pay for. Me, I'm living in the theater these days, and before a New York opening, a theater is a queer sort of atoll, cut off from the world by reefs of rehearsals, not to be approached by land or sea or air. But on the call board, the stage door, the kids, the overworked kids in our company, are putting up their names on a petition against that OPA House bill. They have time enough for that. And at intervals throughout the day and night, they bring me the newspaper and a hamburger, a donut, or a carton of drugstore coffee, and that's how I eat, and that's how I know the news, the newspaper. Hang on to my hand. Let me hang on to yours so neither one of us gets lost. We'll stop at this booth for a minute, an agricultural exhibit. The tableau represents the farmer's future under inflation. Under inflation, farmers will put their grain into cattle because stock prices will soar. To give you an idea how tired I am, there's quite a difference. In the next booth, we have a tableau of starving children. Might be our children, except that they happen to be born on the continent of Europe. Their little eyes are huge with hunger. Patient observers report that these children are never seen to smile. And these children are expected to grow up somehow and somehow to build with us a free world. In their present condition, they don't look much like founding fathers of a European democracy. In point of fact, if we don't get food to them, these little children will starve to death. If our farmers are forced by inflation to put their grain into cattle, we won't have any food to send to them. I'd say goodbye to the little children now and go on to the next booth. But why go on? You're ahead of me, way ahead of me. Hold on to my hands. All this mail deluging the desks of the congressmen may have really shaken deeply the very roots of their misbehavior. The word from Washington this morning is that OPA has a chance to live. Or maybe I'm too tired to know what I'm talking about. But take my hand and I'll take yours. That way we won't get lost. I seem to sense something peculiar and very new in the air. Call it, if you will, an atmosphere. The youngest generation may not recognize it. Teenagers may not even know what it means unless they've read their history books with the most careful study. As I remember, it used to be called an era of good feeling. Another sign that an era of good feeling may be setting in is the news that Mr. Bilbo went home. The man Bilbo, who threatened to filibuster until the end of the year against the British loan, suddenly packed up and drove home to Mississippi. Peckerwoods, said Mr. Bilbo. More Peckerwoods are gnawing away at his chances of re-election. So, after only a two-day filibuster, which for Mr. Bilbo is just time enough for a senator to clear his throat, he went home. Could be that the people of Mississippi are wising up to the wreckers of goodwill. On this weary, woeful morning, I smell hope. And I'm sure of this much, the chances of the British loan have increased, and by a healthy percentage. This Sunday morning, 1 week after Easter, 1 year after the end of the war in Europe, there are some hopeful signs observed by your tired commentator that the tired diplomats have found a modus vivendi, a way of getting along together. From Paris, there comes to a strange sound, strange indeed, and strangely, they don't get headlines smeared in big black block letters. The little one-column banners may read, Big Four reach agreement on Italian peace treaty. But, you know, if I were editing the papers, I'd use big black block letters and underline it with big black block editorials, because, you know, this may really be the end of war. Foreign ministers were grim and grave when they gathered in Paris. They were ready for failure. Jimmy Burns had even gone so far as to whisper to a group of Washington newspaper men in the shrillest confidence that there was every likelihood that no peace treaties would ever be signed as a result of World War II. Our Secretary of State said rather that each of the big four powers might have to sign separate peace treaties, and that this, of course, would mean no peace at all. I talked to somebody on the phone in Washington yesterday who told me that the day before the Paris conference opened, Mr. Burns told the French foreign minister that the United States would not even insist on France being given the right to sit in on all the peace treaties. Burns saying that he felt the Russians would oppose this, Burns being too tired to make a fight. But when the foreign minister sat down at the conference table in Paris Thursday, even the gloomiest of the Cassandras were confounded. The Russians surprised us again. The Russians readily agreed to permitting France to sit at the peace table as full and equal partners. In one short hour, the agenda was agreed to. Mr. Molotov turned out to be as cordial as could be, and Mr. Bevan was flabbergasted. The troublesome Italian issue was put at the top of the list, and this was the same treaty the deputies of the foreign minister has been quarreling over for a month. In four brief hours, three of the knottiest questions had been solved, and the reparations argument was cleared up in 20 minutes, including time out for the translation. People who sometimes know the answers tell me that the Russians have taken other steps to solve differences between the East and West. And so the atmosphere in front of the footlights and behind the scenes for the first time since victory is that of a United Nations. I've kept insisting I'm a very tired play producer. I may be tired. I may be so tired I don't know what I'm talking about. And this cheerful claim of mine may blow up in my face tomorrow. But like the man says, there's good news tonight. I'm never sure of anything. I'm not that kind of a commentator or that kind of a play producer. My voice is hoarse and my head aches, but I'm not speaking this morning at the funeral of OPA or of the United Nations or of my show. I'm still speaking in behalf of the future, and I'm very much inclined to feel okay about it. And though I'm full of aspirin, I'm still full of hope. Let's keep holding hands. That way we won't be lost.
The American Broadcasting Company and its affiliated stations have brought you the personal and individual news commentary of Orson Welles. Be sure to listen again over many of these same stations next Sunday at this same time to Orson Welles' Almanac. This is ABC, the American Broadcasting Company.